Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, you're going to learn about how dietary supplements show amazing promise for reversing cardiovascular aging and a whole lot more on health and healing, all from peer-reviewed journals, supporting the best of consensus science, but for people who are far more progressive than what the scientific community would believe. So they're doing good work. We're verifying it. You're using it. And they're not benefiting. How about that for irony? So we're going to share that. Then I have a guest in the second part of our program. He is an outstanding scholar in the field, and he is Garth Porter. And we're going to talk about the untold story of John Bolton's campaign for war with Iran, the fact that our new CIA director is a pro-war, pro-torture person. She actually ran the black ops site in Thailand that waterboarded people and then destroyed video showing that people died under interrogation by the CIA. Not a good person. Now, you get Bolton and the head of the CIA, this woman, together, and you can almost be guaranteed that within 12 months, 24 months, I would say at the outside, you're going to have a full-blown war with Israel, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, and mostly Saudi Arabia fighting Iran. Iran doesn't want a war. But to show you about the who's really responsible, we're going to give you a detailed, comprehensive history of Iran. They haven't invaded anyone in over 230 years. Do they really represent the axis of evil? Do they need to be destroyed? And you can bet this will be a nuclear strike. So we're going to get into that in depth. Also, continuing with our series of commentaries, today a commentary for the millennials on how you should be working with people of all ages, especially all those people who helped with the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the environmental movement, the animal rights movement, the human rights movement. You have legions of conscientious people who would be only too happy to share their skills and insights and wisdom with you. And yet, up to this point, kind of a brash in your face, intemperance towards anything that you can't take credit for. That's not going to work in your behalf. So today I'm playing two quotes, both from millennials, two millennials, and you'll hear those, and then I'll be giving a commentary today on helping millennials understand the predicament they're in, because if you're not willing to stick your head in the air and look ahead, and if you got it glued to your screen in front of you, you're going to miss all that's happening you can't handle. Also from Professor Henry Giroux, education is a weapon of struggle, rethinking the Parkland uprising and the age of mass violence. We have a lot to share. And please write this number down, because if for any reason you come to your radio program each day at noon, this one, and it's not on, for whatever reason, you can always go to the phone, a hardline phone, your regular old-fashioned phone, a cell phone, a computer phone, and you can hear us. The number is 424-203-8046. Again, please write it down, 424-203-8046. You can't listen live, listen on the archives. 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. And now on your cell phones, there's a little store where you get your apps, and we have a PRN.FM app. And that gives you a crystal clear signal. Now to the latest on health and healing. The University of Colorado has completed a study, and they wanted to look at the long-known fact that when we restrict our caloric intake, when you simply eat less heavy-calorie foods, all right, simple, meat, most mashed potatoes, French fries, pizzas, lots of calories, sugars in foods, desserts, you end up causing premature aging. And we're concerned about premature aging of the heart, the lungs, the brain. And keep in mind that from a public health perspective, anything that we can do that is practical and reasonable to turn off inflammation means our cells are going to live longer. So this study showed that consuming natural dietary supplements, and especially the nicotinamide riboside, the what is called NR, daily, it mimics caloric restriction. And as a result, it helps the pathways leading to the cells and helps the cells. It also improves blood pressure and arterial health, and that means that it helps you if you have hypertension. Quote, this was the first ever study to give this novel compound to humans over a period of time. We found that it is well tolerated and appears to activate some of the same key biological pathways that caloric restriction does. This was published in Nature Communications. So just it's 500 milligrams twice a day, and it just asks for NR. But let me spell it for you. N-I-C-O-T-I-N, N-I-C-O-T-I-N, A-M-I-D-E. Second word, riboside, R-I-B-O-S-I-D-E. So it makes all the difference in keeping you healthy and keeping you, you know, really vital. And this is also part of the nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, which is NAD. And I believe in taking about 100 milligrams of NAD every day or more, 200, 300. From George Washington University, burgers and other foods consumed at restaurants and fast food outlets and cafeterias give you higher levels of the chemicals that can be hormone disruptors in your body. Why would that be? Well, because almost all that stuff is put onto plastic, and that plastic, the container you drink your colas out of and the little basket that French fries come in, that, when it's exposed to heat and all that food that you're getting is hot, releases the chemicals. And when you're eating at home, you're not using those plastics, and therefore you're using regular silverware and plates, and you don't get that in your body. So that's dangerous because that leads to chemicals that disrupt your prostate, your breast. You end up with a higher degree of breast cancer, prostate cancer, ovarian cancer. So bad for you. Also, just one high-fat meal, just one, sets the perfect stage for heart disease. Now, that would seem impossible. I remember when I was asked to debate, and there was a period of my life from about 1972 to about 1980, I did hundreds of debates. In fact, every time the media wanted to see a debate, like on NBC National or ABC in Chicago, they would call me up and say, would you come on and debate the head of the Dairy Association, the Sugar Institute, the chemical? It was always one of these companies, and I'd say, sure. I do my homework, take the information. At that point, I was not a PhD. I didn't have a postdoctoral fellowship. I didn't have publication in peer-reviewed journals. I was just a registered dietitian and an activist, a conscientious consumer and investigative journalist. They would be MDs from Harvard or PhDs. And most of the debates would, at the beginning, centered around their qualifications to talk on a subject, even though they had no background in the subject. How can you come on and talk about organic farming if you've never grown anything organically? You're here to defend the use of DDT or pesticides. How can you talk about diet when you're not a dietitian, you're not a nutritionist? I am, you're not. And so they would say, well, as a doctor, show me the courses you got in you took and you mastered and you use in determining a person's nutritional intake. What do they need? Describe the Krebs cycle. They couldn't. They were functionally illiterate on the very topic they were supposed to be experts on. So after a period of time, they simply stopped debating because they lost every debate. And not because I'm a great debater, it's just that they were completely ignorant of the topic. It was that time when you didn't have to know anything about the topic at hand, you just had to seem significant and important. And one of them, when it came to artificial sweeteners, because I was part of the movement that helped ban saccharin and cyclamates, I did a lot of articles on it. I did a lot of debates. And in one of those debates in Washington, D.C., the man said, you would have to drink 600 colas with artificial sweeteners before you'd have enough of that in your system to make a difference. And I said, well, I happen to know a man who drinks about 6 to 7 of these a day, every day. He's a friend of mine. And because he didn't want to drink the sugar. So if he drank, let's just say the lower amount. Let's say he drank 6 a day times 7 days, 42, times 52 weeks in a year. That's 2,184 sodas he would drink, or 400% more than what you're suggesting a person would have to drink before they manifested cancer or abnormal cells. Now, do you think he's alone? Have you gone to every home where there's someone obese in that house or overweight and asked how many soft drinks you drink with artificial sweeteners? They hadn't thought of that. So now we put to rest the old idea you have to drink 500 of something, because the second part of that issue was, is that the only thing in a person's life every 24 hours they're eating nothing, drinking no water, they're only consuming soft drinks? No, they're eating other foods and other beverages. And how many of those food or beverages also contain chemicals that can alter a person's metabolism, harm their stomach, their digestion, their bacteria? Well, then it turned out there's about 144 chemicals that the average person, toxic chemicals a person puts in their body every 24 hours. So then you don't have to have 500 of one, because their assumption is the lunacy of orthodoxy, that you have nothing else wrong in your life, everything's perfect, there's no other contaminants, artificial sweeteners, nothing else can ever adversely affect your cells except this one thing. Well, now you got all these other things that you're taking into your body that affect it. And therefore, it's not this high amount. So when this Medical College of Georgia at Augusta University found that you only have to have not 500 high-fat meals, one total, one meal, that's it. One meal, not one meal every 24 hours, not one meal every week, one meal. And you set the stage for heart disease. How so? Well, a single high-fat milkshake with a fat and caloric content similar to some enticing restaurant fare can quickly transform our healthy red blood cells into small, spiky cells that wreak havoc inside our blood vessels and help set the perfect stage for cardiovascular disease. Just 4 hours after consuming a milkshake made with whole milk and heavy whipped cream and ice cream, healthy young men also had blood vessels less able to relax and an immune response similar to one provoked by an infection. That's what the team of scientists at the Medical College of Georgia reported and published in the peer-reviewed journal Laboratory Investigations. Now, while the dramatic and unhealthy shift was likely temporary, because there's a period of time where there's a washout, the scientists say that there is a definite cumulative toll from this type of eating, and that their study would explain isolated reports of death or heart attack right after eating a high-fat meal. Quote, we see this hopefully as a public service to get people to think twice about eating this way. The take-home message is that your body can usually handle this if you don't do it again at the next meal or for the next many meals. Okay. Well, we have a lot of cardiologists and other people with backgrounds in medicine listen to this program. I've spoken with them. I've consulted with them. Where do you think a lot of the Orthodox doctors go when there's a serious problem in their family, a daughter, wife, husband? They give me a call. Now, they may not use that information even when they've been helped and disease reversed, but at least they're aware of it. So you could, if you're young, you might get away with this without a lot of damage, but the trouble is, and here's that problem, if people are going to eat a high-fat meal, it's because they like it. It tastes good. It's soft and sweet or crunchy and salty. So they're going to eat it all the time, every day, sometimes several times a day. And that's why when I see people coming into my office who are in their 20s, and I look at all their medical reports, and they have a body, biochemically, it's probably 50. And it's hard for them to comprehend, how can I be this sick? I'm only 23 years old. Well, did you binge drink in college? Yeah, but I'm not in college now. But the damage is still there. Did you take medications? Yeah. And did you eat this way? Well, yes. Well, that's cause and effect. And just remember, the red blood cells are best known for carrying oxygen and are incredibly flexible, so they flow through blood vessels essentially unnoticed. But with a single high-fat meal, they essentially grow spikes and spew poison. They change size, they change shape, they get smaller. And in both the cells and the blood, there's evidence of what is called MPO. That's an enzyme expressed by a type of white blood cell, which at high levels in the blood has been linked to stiff blood vessels. That's bad. Oxidative stress, that's bad. And heart attacks. This myeloperoxidase. And that's what happens. So if you want to impair your ability of blood vessels to dilate, to expand, and then you're going to have to not have those high-fat meals because they can kill you. Remember, red blood cells, probably best known for carrying oxygen, are the most abundant cell type circulating in your blood. You have about 25 trillion, with a T, trillion red blood cells, and they affect every other cell in your body. They also carry and release the energy molecule ATP, adenosine triphosphate, and nitric oxide, which helps your blood vessels relax. And they also help cholesterol circulate. So a healthy red blood cell has a negative charge that keeps them away from other cells and traveling more towards the outer edge of blood vessels in the arterial system. They travel fast. The cells last about 120 days, but like many of us, they become less efficient with age as they use up their energy or their ATP stores. So have that glass of beet juice every day, and especially men, if you have erectile dysfunction, you just can't get it up, have yourself a 60-ounce glass of beet juice, and about an hour later, you'll see the impact of nitric oxide. But if you don't have a problem with that, and you just want to have a healthier workout without having a heart attack, have that same glass of beet juice. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Please stay with us. This is a special message for the Donald. The president seems to have a challenge with English, with history, civics, civility, grammar. I see that he is in the process in many of his statements of conjugating verbs, using the wrong synonyms, using verbs instead of adverbs. He confuses pronouns. My suggestion is threefold. One, that he hires someone to come into the White House. We, the American public, would be willing to pay for this. Someone to teach him civics. Someone to teach him manners. Someone to teach him civility beyond manners. Grammar, elocution, and meditation. I'm sure that if he possessed those qualities, that he would seem less illiterate in everything. So this message is specifically for the Donald. To understand why simplistic, reactive posturing does not solve problems, it compounds them. As an example, today I've chosen the capacity to understand education. You brought into your administration a person who is hard to imagine, but completely harmonized with you in functional literacy when it comes to our educational system, Betty DeVos. Her brother, by the way, is currently under investigation for his position on trying to adversely affect Islam or those who believe in it. And Eric Prince, who his company was also found responsible for the death of a group of people who were not armed and were not a threat to anyone. But that's a separate matter. But under your regime, the Donald, the role of education in producing the formative cultures in and out of schools necessary to support critical thinking and civic courage in critically engaged citizens appears to be disappearing. Words that speak to the truth and hold power accountable are in retreat. And lies are becoming normalized, and the relationship between the truth and the citizens is treated either with disdain or simply ignored. The democratization of information has given way to the democratization of disinformation or disimagination machines, proliferate in corporate-controlled cultural apparatuses, colonized the media and political landscapes. One consequence is that historic memory is not only vanishing in a culture of immediacy and sensationalism and fake news, it is also being written in school textbooks so as to eliminate dangerous memories and align the past with narratives that reinforced anti-democratic ideologies and social relations. In the current historical moment, memory has no place in the dark cave of civic depravity, a space where freedom is abandoned in an educational ecosystem where nothing is true, and the basis for criticizing power collapses under the spectacle of presidential bomb-throwing tweets and endless spectacles of diversion and high-level stretches of newspeak illiteracy. At a time when political extremists and warmongers have moved from the margins of politics to the center of power, a culture of fear and cruelty becomes the essence of politics, reinforced by the degeneration and erasure of any viable notion of morality and personal and social responsibility. But let us pause for a moment and think. When was the last time that in any administration, Truman, Eisenhower, Carter, Ford, all of them, to this day, when was the last time that the President of the United States and that President's cabinet met in an open forum to discuss a truth and reconciliation on all the crimes and misdemeanors against other people and the betrayal of trust in from their own people, and said, this is what we've done. You're not aware of it. These are the agencies engaged in it, the CIA, the National Security Agency, the FBI, the Justice Department, the IRS. We have all engaged in disinformation campaigns. We have brought forth ideologues from think tanks who have not one iota, not a millimeter, of ethics or moral persuasion in their being. And we have allowed them to be fed. As I said on yesterday's program, feed the beast and ultimately it will destroy you. It will consume you. And while we were distracted by our ideologies, our indifference, our hubris, while we were not paying attention, we fed the beast. We chose not to feed Hillary Clinton or Bill Clinton, those beasts, but we fed the Republican beast. And as many people who voted for Trump out of hatred for what the Democrats had done, including many loyal Democrats, union people, poor people, people of color, the very people who were told, we will protect you, we will give you jobs, we will protect your industries, all lied. And this was the final shrug back to say, no more. And yet, they have not taken that responsibility, nor has the media that has protected them. At a time when political extremists and warmongers have such power, the essence of politics reinforced by the idea that there is no normal morality. As a result, we have no notions of social justice, and political visions fall prey to draconian notions of unchecked self-interest and greed. Greed is elevated to a national virtue. And you thought those morons in Hollywood who would show up and protest against guns yet had 500 armed people surrounding their orgy of self-indulgence, narcissism, where they can't go out anywhere unless they have an armed guard. Those who say tear down walls and yet have walls around every one of their homes where they say we are the people. And yet when Madonna and all the rest leave the political opportunes of the naive yelling about it with bombast about how, you know, this and that should be destroyed. Where do they go? Do they go back to Brooklyn? Queens? Where do they go? Do they go back to the neighborhood they grew up in? No. They go back to the gilded cage in which they reside with their foolish, simpleton ideologies. There are a few very good, intelligent, conscientious celebrities. But as a culture, they are not. They're imbecilic, misinformed, and they are insecure in the extreme. And as a result, we are led by people who are pathological liars or people who need attention drawn upon them and using good and honest and legitimate forums, movements that deserve to be respected, but people running them who are not respectful. One of the reasons I have chosen in my own life to support all major causes, but I do not belong to any of those causes, is because I support the movement, but not the people in them. More often than not, my personal experience, and it is my personal experience, is that most of the people I've met in the environmental movement, the health movement, and many other movements need help on a personal level. That is being kind. So today, instead of having good causes that we engage in, and movements educated and fully informed, and things thought through by wise men and women, and not moved simply by a group of people taking to the streets as if the mere fact that we take to the streets means that something is legitimate and our concern is right and we must go forward full force. We'd best stop for a moment and think, where are we going? How will we get there? How can we sustain a movement? In the age of fake news, everything that matters disappears, and institutions that we meant to address crucial social issues and problems begin to vanish. Notions of honesty, honor, respect, and compassion are increasingly policed, and those who advocate them are either muzzled or punished. How else to explain the collective silence of the Vichy-like Republicans supporting Trump's reign of horror and the cravenly actions of the mainstream media, which refuses to engage critically a society that has fallen into the abyss of fascism. One good example of that would be the Laura Ingrams. Charming, personable, highly intelligent, accomplished, and yet supporting people, not asking critical questions of former CIA directors, of the abuses of that director's own regime as well as others, or Sean Hannity. On most occasions and on most issues, I would be on the opposite side of the argument. There's only one thing that he has actually done that I see as legitimate at this time. And this is the irony. Now stop for a moment and think of the irony of ironies. No one would ever imagine someone with a lack of qualifications could become president and then be so obnoxious and so rueful as Donald Trump. And yet, what would have happened had Hillary Clinton been elected? Would you have had any expose of anything? No. You would be beating the drums right now for war with Iran and Russia and China. And we would have had a war probably with Israel leading it, with Saudi Arabia against Iran. And it would be a nuclear war. But it would be one that all the media, the New York Times and all the liberal media, would be supportive of, as they were of the Clintons time and again. There being no in-depth investigations on them. But because of the sense of entitlement that those in power for the last 30 years have had, at least since 1992, they have formed a cohesive cabal of about more or less 10,000 individuals. That includes the Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, it includes the military-industrial complex. You know, right there's 200,000 contractors, many people in banking, the cartels in the energy system, the agricultural complex like Monsanto. So in each and every one of these major areas, there has been nothing except support of whether it's bioengineering and GMO foods, wars around the world, bailing out friends in high places with TARP and the quantitative easing, the degradation of the environment, but also the assault against activists, the assault against our Constitution, our Bill of Rights. So they assumed that they had the right to that, to continue. Had she won, we would have had more of our rights taken away. And it was such a surprise when they saw that he had a chance of winning that they overreached and the deep state actually showed its hand. So if there's anything, even 1 millimeter of good that's come from Trump being president, it's that the deep state overreacted to it and tried to get rid of him. In the process of doing that, they have now exposed what they had going on in the Justice Department and in the FBI and the White House. And I believe over the next 6 months, due to a whole group of people, Sarah Carter and Jarrett and in this case, I give him credit, Sean Hannity, on nothing else, it will be exposed. And then the people will see who was really in control of our country all along and what crimes and misdemeanors they commit. So you see that this fight from the ideal and promise of a substantive democracy is especially dangerous at a time in which the broad-based notion of authoritarian education has become central to politics, and particularly in a digital age in which there is an abundance, over an abundance, of information and a proliferation of educational platforms from schools to the social media. And in the age of Trump, education has lost its alleged role in cultivating an informed, critical citizenry capable of participating in and shaping a democratic society. And lost also is an educational vision that takes people beyond the word that, well, let us use common sense, functions instead as a form of provocation and teaches them to be creative and exposes individuals to a variety of great traditions that historically have been done. Today, we only have a whole group of pedagogical conditions for individuals to expand the range of their own interest under the influence of corporate power and a growing authoritarianism in the United States the state has become the enabler, and the state has become the provocateur. Education in multiple informal and formal platforms operates increasingly in the service of lies and racism and unadulterated market values and a full-fledged assault on critical consciousness and public values. And under such circumstances, democracy is cast as the enemy of freedom and politics turns dark. These anti-democratic tendencies are evident in the ways in which neoliberalism since the 1980s has reshaped formal education at all levels into a site for training, alienating market values, and imposing commercial relations as a template for governing all social life. Every idea, every value, every social relationship, every institution, and every form of knowledge runs the risk of being economized, turned into either a commodity, a brand, or a source of profits, or all of the latter. Increasingly aligned with market forces and public and higher education are mostly primed for teaching business principles and corporate values, while the university administrators are prized as CEOs or bureaucrats in an audit culture. And how then does the student benefit? They do not. How are they harmed? Severely. Because what happens when a mass of young minds goes into the world to make a difference? And you think, good for them, they're finally joining us by the millions. And you realize what mind they're bringing into the movements. The vacuity, the bias, the unintelligible construct, lacking context, depth, scholarship, patience, empathy, and reflection and introspection. Wonder what could go wrong with that. I'm going to play you now a short segment. This is 4 minutes and 58 seconds long. This is by a young millennial speaking truth poetically about his generation and what we can learn from it.
122 friends, yet I'm lonely. I speak to all of them every day, yet none of them really know me. The problem I have sits in the spaces between, looking into their eyes or at a name on a screen. I took a step back and opened my eyes. I looked around and realised that this media we call social is anything but when we open our computers and it's our doors we shut. All this technology we have, it's just an illusion. Community companionship, a sense of inclusion. Yet when you step away from this device of delusion, you awaken to see a world of confusion. A world where we're slaves to the technology we mastered, where information gets sold by some rich, greedy bastard. A world of self-interest, self-image, self-promotion, where we all share our best bits but leave out the emotion. We're at our most happy with an experience we share, but is it the same if no one is there? Be there for your friends, and they'll be there too, but no one will be if a group message will do. We edit and exaggerate, crave adulation. We pretend not to notice the social isolation. We put our words into order until our lives are glistening. We don't even know if anyone is listening. Being alone isn't a problem. Let me just emphasise, if you read a book, paint a picture, or do some exercise, you're being productive and present, not reserved and recluse. You're being awake and attentive and putting your time to good use. So when you're in public and you start to feel alone, put your hands behind your head, step away from the phone. You don't need to stare at your menu or at your contact list. Just talk to one another. Learn to coexist. I can't stand to hear the silence of a busy commuter train where no one wants to talk through the fear of looking insane. We're becoming unsocial. It no longer satisfies to engage with one another and look into someone's eyes. We're surrounded by children who, since they were born, have watched us living like robots and think it's the norm. It's not very likely you'll make world's greatest dad if you can't entertain a child without using an iPad. When I was a child, I'd never be home. Be out with my friends on our bikes we would roam. I'd wear holes in my trainers and graze up my knees. We'd build our own clubhouse high up in the trees. Now the park's so quiet it gives me a chill. See no children outside and the swings hanging still. There's no skipping, no hopscotch, no church and no steeple. We're a generation of idiots, smartphones and dumb people. So look up from your phone, shut down the display. Take in your surroundings, make the most of today. Just one real connection is all it can take to show you the difference that being there can make. Be there in the moment that she gives you the look that you remember forever as when love overtook. The time she first holds your hand or first kiss your lips. The time you first disagree but still love her to bits. The time you don't have to tell hundreds of what you've just done because you want to share this moment with just this one. The time you'll sell your computer so you can buy a ring for the girl of your dreams who is now the real thing. The time you want to start a family and the moment when you first hold your little girl and get to fall in love again. The time she keeps you up at night and all you want is rest. And the time you wipe away the tears as your baby flees the nest. The time your baby girl returns with a boy for you to hold. And the time he calls you granddad and makes you feel real old. The time you take in all you've made just by giving life attention. And how you're glad you didn't waste it by looking down at some invention. The time you hold your wife's hand, sit down beside her bed. You tell her that you love her, lay a kiss upon her head. She then whispers to you quietly, as her heart gives a final beat, that she's lucky she got stopped by that lost boy in the street. But none of these times ever happened. You never had any of this. When you're too busy looking down, you don't see the chances you miss. So look up from your phone, shut down those displays. We have a finite existence, a set number of days. Don't waste your life getting caught in the net, as when the end comes, nothing's worse than regret. I'm guilty too of being part of this machine, this digital world we are heard but not seen, where we type as we talk and we read as we chat, where we spend hours together without making eye contact. So don't give in to a life where you follow the hype. Give people your love, don't give them your like. Disconnect from the need to be heard and defined. Go out into the world, leave distractions behind. Look up from your phone, shut down that display. Stop watching this video, live life the real way.
A powerful message. I'll continue tomorrow with commentary of how millennials can work productively with older generations in making it a better world. Now we're going over and say hello to Dr. Garth Porter in Northern Virginia. He is a multi-award-winning historian, an independent investigative journalist and policy analyst who specializes in U.S. geopolitics and national security issues. And during the Vietnam War, he was a Dispatch News Service Bureau chief in Saigon and later co-director for the Indochina Resource Center. In addition to being a specialist in Vietnamese and Cambodian affairs, he's been reporting on the Middle East, including the chemical gas attacks reported in Syria, for the past decade. And his numerous articles can be found on Foreign Affairs, Al Jazeera, Huffington, Counterpunch, Truthout, Consortium. And he is also the author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, which debunks the myths regarding Iran and a nuclear threat. Nice to have you with us today, Garth.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Gary.
Right now, we're witnessing a powerful military pact forming between the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia, and we can certainly include the U.K. and other allies as well. And all these players are staunch enemies of Iran and eager to wage war in order to create regime change. And moreover, John Bolton is now in charge of the National Security Agency's communications with the president, as he's his top national security advisor. Pompeo was the head of the CIA, and he has one of the most rabid pro-Israel and anti-Iran positions as neocons in charge of Middle East affairs in the White House. And then we have the new CIA nominee director. She ran the Thailand black op and was responsible for waterboarding and also destroying videos. These are the people counseling him on what to do. So before we get into a lot of in our society with the New York Times and CNN, I can see it already drumming for war as they did in 1992 up to 1993, invade of Iraq. Why don't you take us on a history of Iran so we can determine if Iran really is a threat or if this is just another regime change scam. So take us back to Iran before the U.S. under Eisenhower and the U.K. under Churchill led to the coup to oust Mossadegh. And Churchill, by the way, came back in office from 1951 to 55 after the Clement Attlee situation. What was Iran like before the coup, and how was Mossadegh covertly ousted? Because we've done the same thing in Syria and in Libya, same operation. So talk about the history of Iran.
Okay, sure. You know, what I would try to do here is to really provide a very brief capsule summary, just touching on the absolutely key points that I think you have in mind. And if you go back to before 1953, when President Mossadegh was ousted by the CIA, Iran was in the process of doing two things. It was trying to build a democratic system on one hand, and on the other hand, it was resisting the British effort to basically steal Iran's oil resources. And this is you know, those two things really went together very very closely. Because, of course, Iran is a very nationalist country. The people there are very strongly nationalist, proud of their history. They have an extremely long 1,000-year history of proud civilization. And the British came in and were able to get control over their petroleum resources and essentially owned them. And the Iranians basically rebelled. During the Mossadegh government period, Mossadegh essentially nationalized the oil resources of Iran, and the British were beside themselves with anger. And the British government essentially went to Eisenhower, the Eisenhower administration. Actually, they began really under the Truman administration, but continued this effort after Eisenhower was elected in 1952, to get the United States to carry their water and to get rid of this government on the ground that they were extremists, that they would play into the hands of the communists. And, of course, the real reason was transparent, that they wanted to get their control over the oil back. And the Eisenhower administration went along with this and is now so excruciatingly well documented that the CIA basically paid off people to carry out demonstrations. Basically, thugs that they recruited were put on the street. And the outcome was that Mossadegh was overthrown and the Shah was put back into power after having had to leave the country during the Mossadegh period. And of course, the Shah then became the proxy for the U.S. in the Middle East on a whole series of levels. And the U.S. created a new police state in Iran that lasted until 1979. And of course, that was when the Shah's regime was overthrown by a huge majority of the Iranian people, after, of course, a period of crisis during which the Carter administration, which was in the White House at that time, was not sure which way to go. And Zbigniew Brzezinski was counseling in White House meetings the president to call for the Shah's police to simply shoot as many demonstrators as necessary to keep the Shah in power. So, you know, that would be my capsule summary of the history that is so important in terms of understanding the Iranian viewpoint on the United States. And I mean by that not just the Islamic Republic, but generally speaking, the average Iranian is going to view the United States from a point of view that is largely defined by that history.
Thank you for that overview. How dangerous are the tensions between the Iranian and U.S.-Israeli-led group that now has Bolton and Pompeo heading their respective federal departments. And recently you wrote an article about Bolton's obsession with invading Iran and how he was instrumental during the Bush years in creating the mythology of Iran's nuclear capabilities as the Middle East's greatest threat. And what would you predict the outcome of a war or an invasion of Iran to be? Because Iran is not Iraq. It is a far larger country with a huge army, and it has the means to strike back, at least against Saudi Arabia. And we don't know what it's done on a technological level to use a part of its pushback as cyber warfare as well, when it itself was the victim of National Security Agency and Israeli cyber warfare when they tried to turn off all the electricity in Iraq and start the explosion of their nuclear fuel materials, their centrifuges, and make it look like this was all in their system when it was actually planted there by the United States and by Israel. So take us on that journey now.
Sure. So, I mean, I think we begin with the fundamental situation that Iran faced in regard to its security after the revolution of 1979. Iran was really not a military power at all. It has never had, and I mean by this now the Islamic Republic of Iran, has never been a real military power. They do not have the ability, nor have they had the inclination, to build the military capability to project power beyond its own borders. And this is the fundamental fact that I think is, you know, the successive U.S. administrations that have taken such a hostile attitude and policy toward Iran ever since the Islamic Republic was created, have tried to keep out of the news, keep out of the presentation of issues surrounding Iran ever since then. And so that's the starting point. And then secondly, I think as soon as the Islamic Republic was created, the issue of what to do about the Shah's nuclear program obviously came up because they had an unfinished nuclear reactor that the United States government had supported. Westinghouse helped to build it and was of course, lobbying in favor of it. And Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon and successive U.S. administrations had been in favor of it because the Shah was our guy, and therefore we wanted to support both the Shah and Westinghouse. But as soon as the Islamic Republic was created, then you had an immediate change of heart, and the successive U.S. administrations wanted to basically overthrow the Islamic Republic as soon as an opportunity presented itself. And then you had Saddam Hussein invading Iran, and this is the key point that I'm getting to. 1981, the war by the Saddam Hussein regime against Iran began with apparently the approval of the Carter administration, which was just ending its time in office in 1980-81, or 81-82, I should say. And so there was an understanding that Saddam Hussein had a green light. And during that war, Iran basically was subjected to chemical weapons attacks, not only against its troops, but against cities and civilian populations. And the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which was in charge of Iran's military defense against the Saddam Hussein regime, very strongly pushed Khomeini, the Ayatollah who had been the founding father of Islamic State in Iran, to build nuclear weapons, to have a nuclear weapons program and a chemical and biological weapons program. Khomeini said no. He said, that is not something we can do as an Islamic state. It's against Islamic law, and we will not do it. We cannot possess such weapons. We cannot use such weapons. We cannot produce such weapons. So they were never able to convince Khomeini to go ahead and do it. And that has remained the attitude of Iran towards weapons of mass destruction of all kinds ever since. And I think this is the most important evidence that Iran's claim that it is not interested in weapons of mass destruction, and particularly not interested in nuclear weapons, is in fact the truth. And I have been publishing that, and no one has ever responded with any argument that in any way, shape, or form would weaken the force of that argument. And in my book, Manufactured Crisis, I document over and over again the propaganda that has been put forward suggesting that Iran was pursuing nuclear weapons, interested in nuclear weapons, and then pursuing nuclear weapons has been systematically fraudulent. And the most important part of that fraudulent evidence was a set of documents that I show in my book did not come from an actual Iranian nuclear weapons related research program, but from the Mujahideen-e Khalq giving the documents to Western intelligence. Now, where did Mujahideen-e Khalq, the Iranian opposition terrorist organization, get those documents? Well, I make the argument that there's a lot of circumstantial evidence, very strong circumstantial evidence, that it came from the Israeli Mossad International Intelligence Organization. And okay. I show that those documents were fraudulent. There's a series of indications that I can't go into detail now, but if people are interested, they can find the details in my book that leave no doubt that those documents were fraudulent. They were not genuine documents from an Iranian nuclear weapons program.
I appreciate you sharing these insights with us, because we're going to see now a real upbeat in the uptick in the propaganda to invade Iran, and all based upon their threat of nuclear. And yet the international nuclear agencies are there in Iran. They have cameras and monitoring and on-ground inspections all the times. They have found no evidence whatsoever that Iran is building any nuclear facility for creating weapons. And yet Bolton and the others will be out there mouthing just the opposite, and Fox and all the rest will be giving them a constant form to do so. So I appreciate your coming up there with a counterbalancing opinion. And again, people can read the book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, by my guest, who's on the phone from down in Virginia, Dr. Gareth Porter. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
We're out of time, everyone. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.